Hi everyone. So we're here and we're so excited to jump on and do this recording and get some information out there and just be able to share some factual points about perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. And we were so excited when we had Gabby and Braden be willing to come on and share their experience with us. We're so grateful to have them. This is incredibly personal and vulnerable. And so I'm going to let them introduce themselves and share their experience and what they went through with postpartum psychosis.
Thank you, Lindsay. My name's Gabby.
I'm Brandon.
And we are a couple that experienced postpartum psychosis after the birth of our first child. And let's see where to get started. When I think about the experience overall, there's kind of two pieces of it for myself. And one of them was thinking about my, Gabby's mental health before the psychotic episode and then what it looks like after. And with the benefit of hindsight, I certainly have always kind of trended towards anxiety, but this was my first child and I was a very anxious new mom. And during pregnancy, it really kind of started to ramp up and I just put just tremendous amount of pressure on myself about having the perfect pregnancy, doing it right, doing it the right way, researching, vitamins and exercise routines and baby care items. It just never ended. And I noticed kind of towards the end of pregnancy that was getting a little bit, a little bit worse. And Brandon would kind of say, chill, like it's okay, and we're gonna be just fine. And then our son was born and I had a really specific birth plan that I wanted and it ended up not working out. And the way that I had hoped it was going to. And I made a lot of meaning already about how I had kind of failed my son because, I didn't have this beautiful natural birth. And then the meaning was made about everything. He had a little bit of jaundice. And I just remember we have a picture of me just cradling him exhausted. And I was just frantically searching the internet and just asking everybody what we could do. He was having a hard time like sucking on a pacifier. And I remember calling my mom in the middle of the night, just that new parent panic. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of in the anxiety range, but then kind of the sleep deprivation of a new parent. And that kind of started to turn into something completely different. With the benefit of hindsight, I probably had some perinatal anxiety going on there, but then things really changed. And suddenly it was from being kind of nervous. And so when I was supposed to be sleeping, I was just kind of anxiously Googling things to suddenly I didn't need to sleep. I wasn't tired. I didn't need to sleep. And I could not go to sleep when it was time, when I just couldn't relax my body down. And then I kind of started to get some strange ideas. It was kind of around Black Friday. And so, I started shopping for gifts for other people. And I really wanted my son's first Christmas to be incredible. So buying decorations, and I was always out of the house. And my husband was home with our son. I was out shopping, which is not like me. This was out of character. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of turned into a scarier direction, at least for myself. I started kind of having sensory changes. So, I started hearing that I could hear people kind of outside our front door. They were maybe talking about coming and hurting my son. I really had it in my mind that other people were trying to hurt my son and I really needed to protect him. And so kind of the sound changes came first. And then I started to notice visually. So, I'd be holding my son and I would have what I know now would be a kind of an intrusive thought of something really bad happening to him. And it wasn't just in my mind anymore. The picture wasn't in my mind. I was visually seeing it happen in front of me. And it was so terrifying. Mm-hmm. And it was even more confusing because I was kind of having this euphoric high of buying things. And when I was out, it was okay. But when I was with my son, when I was home, it just felt wrong. Everything felt wrong and really scary. And I don't know, Brandon, you can kind of share.
Yeah, I think as the spouse, like witnessing it, it's also our first child. So I'm thinking through like, okay, well, like I'm changing a lot. And like, you know, Brandon as a dad is a different person. I feel differently. And, you know, she's just going through something that's different. And then, you know, you'd hear things about like the voices outside the front door. And it's like, if we lived in an apartment and there are weird people across the hall. So like, maybe she did hear something, but it wasn't quite like that. Right. Mm-hmm. And so you're trying to explain things in your own mind as the spouse that's witnessing this. And nobody's first thought is like, oh, this is an urgent medical emergency. Right.
Right.
Because this is so rare. Right. You don't go straight there. And so I think it was after probably like multiple days of the abnormal behavior, the shopping, which I can attest to is, you know, I'm the one that goes shopping in our family, actually. Like it was very odd that she jumped in with both feet. And then, you know, there were a couple of other examples about wanting to move and things like that. So that's when it started to get, you know, I remember hearing, you know, just culturally, I can even think of a resource before all this happened of postpartum depression and anxiety. And it's like being in a medical emergency where you like, you did CPR, but it was a couple of years ago and you can't quite remember what you're supposed to do. And it's a terrible feeling. I started to think like, well, maybe this is something like that, because I've heard of those things. But I don't feel like I studied for the test well enough at that time. And so I remember the day that it changed, and it was, I think the day after Black Friday,
or maybe.
And she had made an appointment for us to go and look at another home to rent, and was difficult to get a hold of. I was with our son, and we met up, and she was kind of out of breath, like hyperventilating, and just said like, I don't feel good. Like maybe I'm getting sick. And we're sitting in the car, and I'm starting to think through, this is again, multiple days of strange behavior. What are we going to do about this? Because we can't continue. And we lived in a city away from all of our family. So it's us alone. Right. And I'm starting to realize that I need help with this situation. Like I can't handle this. We can't go and do like a relaxing bath at home. Like this is beyond that. And so I remember I felt bad at the time, but I kind of lied to her and said like, you know, I steered into the anxiety, and you guys as the professionals can tell me if this was appropriate, but I said like, you know, if you're not feeling well, maybe he's not feeling well as well, right? If you have a cold or the flu, maybe he does, and we should go get him checked out, because she was very resistant to going to the hospital.
I did not think I needed help.
So, So we drove from there to the emergency department and got there and said, hey, you know, my family's not, is kind of under the weather, you know. And as soon as we got into the room, I left the room and looked for the you know, aide. And I said, like, we're actually not here for my son. I'm really concerned about my wife. Mm-hmm. And they didn't understand either the symptoms that they were describing. So even within the medical community, there's not a lot of awareness. And I ended up talking to the physician on duty, and she didn't understand either. So Gabby started to be evaluated. They started to call in more professionals, a psychiatrist, a mental health professional from the county to come in and evaluate her. And I'll never forget, like, it was really upsetting. And it's to this day upsetting. The physician came to me and said, you know, we're not sure what's wrong, but you need to be prepared for this being your future. She may never change. And she said, like, this could be a permanent change in her. And I was like, how do you receive that news, right? We have a 14-day-old. They're telling me one thing. The psychiatrist comes in, and I'll never forget, like, her first response. And it was almost like, I don't know, like passive, not dismissive, but so confident, like, oh, well, we're going to be able to figure this out. And that was the first person that said, like, oh, like, I've seen this before. We can handle this. We can do this together. Right. And I know that meant a lot. So after that, you went into an inpatient program. You can speak more to that. And then we were off to the races.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, they can speak to it, but I am forever grateful for the lie, or, you know, the way you got me there, because I think that is such a piece when I share and talk with other families. How do I physically get this person into the facility, right?
Yes.
And if it has to be a ruse, then mm-hmm. I mean, it was a medical crisis. Like, we were in a medical emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And
they could actually see that physiologically, like as they evaluated her, like very elevated heart rate, elevated blood pressure, right? Like her, mm-hmm. her body was physically responding to what was happening. And they could see that her body was in distress.
Right. Well, and Brandon, I think like you could not have done anything more, like,
no,
it's more perfect, because when we, you know, at least how we're taught and how I've even experienced with people that are in that like altered state of reality or in, you know, experiencing that psychosis, you can't say you are not yourself right now and we need to go get you checked out. It actually can make them more agitated, more scared, and more resistant. And so it just really is brilliant of how you kind of just leaned into more of what she was already worried about, and let's go check out our son and let's go make sure this is okay. And I just think that that's such a huge thing for you to make a point of just, you don't need to try and challenge them on what they're thinking or what they're doing or this behavior that they're having. That the really the goal is to get some medical help and get it, someone else get eyes on them, someone that kind of knows what they're doing, and any way that you can do it along, you know, especially, I mean, you kept her safe, you kept your son safe, like
mm-hmm.
there could not have been a more beautiful way to handle it, in my opinion. And just getting other eyes on her and getting care quickly. And yes, I can see where you would be very upset with how that doctor gave you that advice of that Gabby would never be different, or this was your new life, and how discouraging that probably was to hear.
Yeah, I think it's an emergency department physician, right? So they're probably not used to seeing those things.
Right.
And my advice, like to myself going back in time, would have been like, ask for a perinatal psychiatrist, right? Like this is a psychiatric issue. So yeah. Don't expect to go to the broken bone doctor in the emergency department and expect right. them to be able to know exactly what to do, right? Like she had to go do some research on the computer, but if you can even skip that step or seek medical care and then ask for a psychiatrist, especially one that specializes in this type of issue, mm-hmm. would have, I mean, saved me days of stress.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It almost sounds like, Brandon, like you intuitively knew something. I don't know what mm-hmm. or necessarily exactly what it is, but something is not right. And that is so different than just worrying or anxiously thinking something bad's going to happen. It really sounds like you felt something was not wrong, right? And you acted. And
exactly. I appreciate that. I wonder sometimes too, if being away from family was almost an advantage.
Yeah.
Because if we had been near both of our families, that, you know, that's usually your first call, right? Is mom or brother, sister, whatever. Yes. And saying like, have you ever seen this before? And who knows what advice you would get, right? Yeah. And if they had, you know, tried to just address this within the family, or, you know, we'll just watch him for a couple nights and you guys can get back to normal, right? Mm-hmm. I think that if anyone is concerned about an issue like this, it is easier to just seek medical attention or a professional opinion immediately. And if they give you a clean bill of health and you move on, then that's great. But, you know, they may also be able to give you an actual intervention in a way that your family can't.
Right. I love that. I love too that, you know, you didn't just stop when no one understood you. You had this like profound, I don't know, husband power, maybe spouse power, right? To be an advocate. Exactly. You advocated in such a difficult part. Like, cause I think we meet up with medical professionals and we're like, you're the medical professional, right? But man, it was such a good example of no, like I need you to hear me. I need you to see me. And you didn't stop. I think that's so cool.
Advocacy.
Yeah. That advocacy piece.
Yeah.
Huge. And I think our moms see that too. Like they go to someone that maybe doesn't understand them and then they get really discouraged. Right. But I think your example is just like, yeah, maybe someone doesn't understand you right away, but that doesn't mean you stop. That doesn't mean you stop being seen and heard. I think that was incredible. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Trusting yourself, listening to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Gabby, tell us a little bit more about, like, you know, once you obviously went in and you were in the hospital, you know, I would love for you to touch a little bit on, obviously you can't tell me exactly probably what you knew in that moment, but I think there's sometimes this belief that or people don't have an understanding of when someone is experiencing psychosis, they are in an altered state of reality. They don't know what, like, they're doing, they're making decisions, their thoughts are disorganized. Can you speak to if you have memory of this experience or what was going on for you when this was happening?
Yeah, I was going to say, meanwhile, in the room next door, I really appreciate the way you say that, which was the Gabby now, right? When I look back on that time, altered is a phenomenal word for it. So, I mean, to this point, I had spent $16,000 in the span of a couple of days. I was researching how I could join the Navy SEALs so that I could, I could become a protector. Mm-hmm. That's not my career. That's not Gabby, right? I was researching. I'm really interested in that. I had started looking about how to join it. I had heard a Macklemore song. We lived in Seattle at the time at some point. And I don't know that we've talked about this much. I had started to connect because I was at the mall. And at some point, I guess Macklemore had actually been at the mall at that day. And when you're having a really manic episode, everything connects. And so I had convinced myself that he was there because I was there and like that we knew each other, right? And that connection to celebrity is actually a sign, right, of this altered mental status. And so when I got to the hospital, I was under the impression that I was here for physical issues because I had walked, like, I mean, I'm 14 days out from having a child. I had walked like 10 plus miles at the mall. I was not resting. I was not eating. So I thought I was there to get like an IV and some sleep meds and then like, you know, pat on the butt and get back in the game. And that mental status, I think one of the other pieces is it's hard to convey how long that went on for. I believed that and I 100% believed what was going on for sure through the emergency department. When we kind of had our eye, they kind of knew what was going on behind the scenes. Then they had a sitter come and I do have some medical experience. So I was like, oh, I don't know what that's about. And then got moved to the labor and delivery unit, which is actually where we had had our son, right, 2 weeks before. The same nurses cared for me. And kind of then too, I was still kind of thinking it was physical and very much still 100% believing that what was going on, that my experience was reality. And it took, I mean, I would say at least a week to maybe 2 weeks. And at that time, thankfully, they were able, so right, the labor and delivery, I was able to have my son there during the day and sleep at night. But unfortunately, the inpatient unit, right, it's just a general psychiatric inpatient unit, and we were waiting for a bed. And when that transition happened was kind of when I wasn't back to my right mind, but I kind of started to put together like, oh my gosh, everybody else's face is really worried. I'm doing fine over here. But all their faces match and there's something wrong, but I could not figure it out.
Sure.
And so, that when they transition you from from transitioning me from the hospital into the inpatient behavioral health unit, the nurse that I just love, 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 she came in crying. And that's, well, I was not, she had not done that before. And she just was really tearful when she explained, you know, you, because this is a psychiatric issue, we have to handcuff you to the bed while you get transported. It's a safety issue. And it was kind of the first time where, you know, my first thought was like, I'm actually like a bad person. Like I'm a criminal. And they give you a lot of medicine to kind of snow you out a little bit because it is such a distressing time. And so I was really groggy in that transition. I'm grateful that I was groggy because it, you know, when I woke up right in a completely different place, the cloud kind of started to lift. And not again, not completely, but just enough insight to know like I had really messed up. And again, the shame and the like the guilt and the what have I done? Like what have I done? Yeah. And that
it's probably like, you know, like you go out for like a crazy night of partying, right? And then you wake up and you're like, oh, what did I do? Right. But that's the story that the patient is telling themselves is like, what have I done?
Right.
But really to us, to all of us, it's no different than like having a heart attack, right? So it wasn't you that was doing that. It was you, your brain was on drugs. You didn't get to enjoy any of the benefit of that. but you were a different person at the time almost. And it's the most insidious part of this disease probably is you know, the days, weeks, years afterward where you're sorting through that, like I did this versus like this happened to me and I can move on, right? The shame and the guilt of what happened, the stories, like it's been 5 years now. And I would say only recently in probably the last 2 years that we've been able to really talk about this openly and together a lot and it not be just really painful.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Huge.
Yeah. And well, and just, I mean, I don't think there, unless you've experienced, would there be anything like it quite of like, no. I did things and people are telling me I did them.
Right. She also didn't remember a lot of what
happened. Right. Right. And I don't remember all of it. And, but it felt as clear, as real as us speaking right now. Right.
Yeah.
And, so confusing and so confusing to the brain, right? And yes, just it is watching a mom come out of psychosis. It is very unsettling in the way of seeing that shame and that embarrassment they experience and this like trying to disconnect of like that wasn't me, but like it, I did it, and but it was the illness and not me and myself, and it is right. Really hard for that person that's experienced it to do that.
I think where you can take personal accountability is it happened once and you learned from it, but if it, you know, continues to happen, then that is something that you need to focus on as an individual and how to keep yourself healthy for everyone around you if you want to have stable and healthy relationships. And I think that, you know, a second part to our story was ceasing to take medication.
Yep.
And that's a, you know, something we can get into as well. And then learning from that experience as well. And then realizing that, you know, I am a person that needs to take medication for this, and that's okay because it makes me the healthiest version of myself, right?
Right.
And so I think that's where you can focus on personal accountability if that's important to you. Because I know that, you know, as things have been in the news, people talk about that a lot, right? Is where's the personal responsibility? And I think that is it, is learning from the experience and then growing to be the healthiest version of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a journey too. And it might not be one and done.
No. Yes. And I think that, Gabby, if like, so you went home and kind of with the progression of just where things went after you mm-hmm. went to the ER and then were in the labor and delivery floor and then put up onto the behavioral health unit and just kind of where, you know, what transpired after you released and yes, with these situations, it is a journey and the recovery is not just, okay, we leave and meds are onboarded and okay, now here we go. It can be a figuring out of those meds. It can, I maybe don't need those meds and still kind of figuring out if I believe this is really going on. It's just, it's a journey. And speak a little bit more to that, Gabby.
Yeah, absolutely. I made a lot of meaning about the medication. And, you know, in the beginning on the psychiatric unit, right, it's your brain is essentially a runaway truck. And so the medication you're taking is the runaway truck ramp, right? Like we have to stop this vehicle. These are some heavy duty, right, medications. Thank heavens, there is something, right, that stops it. And so, you know, starting there, right, where you're just very sedated and you know, again, like kind of coming to, and then I had great help in that transition. And if, you know, from, you know, we're in the unit and now we're headed home. And it was encouraging to see the confidence in providers because I had no confidence in myself. Right. I was kind of stewing in this spot of like, you know, I feel like I failed my, you know, my body failed me when I had my son and now I can't even trust my mind. Like my mind is playing tricks on me and I have no trust in myself. And so to see the confidence of the providers in, right, we've seen this before. Let's, you know, start working through the plan, the treatment plan here. And one of the pieces that was such a reassurance, I think, for both of us was we happened to be in Washington where they have a outpatient day treatment program that's maternal mental health specific. Mm-hmm. And so, we were moving into good hands. And I think that was certainly one of the pieces that was a reassurance, but I cannot understate how, even when it's, you have that next step, to get in, right. Packing my son up in the stroller, driving in, right, and getting there was, I mean, hell. It was just, it was so much, right, after not, you know, I was by myself in the unit, they visited, and then now here we are talking about bonding, and, you know, let's baby massage, and, you know, and then talking about your mental health, and I was still spinning. I mean, I understand, right. I needed to, that was a landing spot. And thankfully the program was pretty lengthy because I really, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, I don't even think I was absorbing much of the information until maybe week 6 or 7. I call it like etch-a-sketch brain, right? Yeah. I was in the room holding my son. We were talking, I was engaging in conversation, but it was like, I shook my head at the end of the day and, you know, forgot most of the information. Kind of in the group too was a little bit difficult because, you know, I was coming in by necessity from, you know, the higher level of care. And when I got in there, it was other moms, which was a feeling of not being alone. Right. Mm-hmm. There's other people in the bad moms club, like, oh, the relief of like, there's somebody else, you know, and I say that, right, with the way at that time that I thought of myself, which was a bad mom. And I know so different now, but at the time it was like, oh, here's the island of misfit toys. I finally found at least a room where I can cry about how awful, you know, how awful this is. Mm-hmm. But it was hard too, because there was not another mom who had also experienced postpartum psychosis. Mm-hmm. And so there was kind of this piece, and we were talking about where it was like, I didn't want to share like my deepest, darkest thoughts, mm-hmm. because I was like, this, you know, we have a piece that connects us, but my thoughts were so much darker and scarier. Yeah. And, you know, I thought Nakamura was my best friend, right? Like there's a piece of it that you just don't want to share. Yeah. And I had also, And again, the learning experience for me, I had really gotten in my mind because I had heard other moms with different conditions telling me that at 6 months, they you don't have to take meds anymore. Like, you know, oh, I've got depression and my eye doctor said 6 months, 8 months, and we're done. And I just wanted to be done. Like I wanted that so bad for myself too, to think that this was just like a horrible blip. And then, you know, I get to go back and be done. And I made a lot of meaning about that. And I also was not honest with my providers about the meaning I had made of that and what it meant that there was a possibility that I was bipolar and would need to take medication for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't tell anybody when I stopped taking the medication. And I think that was at about 8 months, 6 months, 8 months, right in there.
Yeah, I don't remember.
And the backslide was, you know, for the first time, I think the people around me, it was more frightening for because they didn't know what was going on. Mm-hmm. But the second time when stopped taking my medication and the slow backslide into severe depression and suicidal thoughts that had turned into suicidal plans that, you know, gathering means very quietly. And mm-hmm. I think that's another piece about the condition, which is outwardly, I was holding a 40-hour job. Mm-hmm. I was out and around people. I was flying home to visit family in Utah. And so I think people were thinking, oh, like Gabby's on the way, like Gabby's on her way. Things are getting better. But that was a completely different internal experience. It was really bad. And I didn't tell anybody.
Well, I think as you take medication and you do start to feel really good, then you're saying like, oh yeah, I'm better. Like I don't
need exactly this anymore. That's right? Exactly. Yeah.
And then you don't realize when you stop taking it that it's just kind of like a ticking time bomb almost. And I thought you were doing really well. Like you said, the people around us did. Like you went on a vacation with a friend, and it was when you came back that the second episode really kicked off, and that one was actually much darker. And if I hadn't been concerned the first go around that you were going to hurt yourself or anyone around you, even though I maybe should have been more concerned about you harming yourself at the time, especially given everything that happened afterward. But the second one got really dark and was pretty clear, even knowing like we have an excellent psychiatrist, like we have an excellent support system, it still didn't work. And it felt very defeating for me, like I had failed, like what is our future? How is this going to work out? If you don't take your health seriously, how can I take the health of our family seriously? It was really challenging. But I remember first and foremost thinking like, we have to get you to medical care. And it was like, I mean, we'll both remember that day for the rest of our lives, getting you to in Utah to uni through our psychiatrist, and how understanding, again, like so different than like the emergency medicine community, but like the emergency psychiatric community, so patient and understanding. I'm picking up the phone now, I'm calling them, you're going there, you'll meet with Tanya, like, right? Yeah. So accommodating. And then when you were released from that program, back on your medication, we talked a lot, you know, during daily visits about yourself and the improvements that you were going to make and committed to. And that was really important, was just honest and open dialogue. And for me, like, as the spouse of things are happening to me, right, that I can't necessarily control. And it's easy to take that personally and want to retreat from it and not be a part of the situation anymore. But to say, like, I mean, I remember at the time thinking, and I think we even talked about this, I'm, you know, we may or may not make it, mm-hmm. but I'm going to
marriage.
Right.
Marriage. Okay. Marriage.
Yeah, good qualifier. Our relationship may or may not make it. But I need to make sure that we see you through to be the healthiest mom that you can be for Sagan. And hopefully I'm a part of that. But at the time it felt like that wasn't for sure.
No.
Right.
No.
And that was really scary. And then fortunately, when we got out of uni, I say we, but when you graduated from the program, You had like an excellent, excellent referral to Serenity, and I will forever be so grateful for the help that we got at Serenity. And I think it truly saved your life, and it saved our marriage, the intervention that we got from Lindsay and her team.
Yeah.
I love that. I love the, I think it's such a real and human experience, right? Like you guys were alluding to, like, we feel better, you know, we want to take our power back in some ways and be in control of our lives again. And that, and for you, Gabby, that kind of looked like, you know, going off those meds in a way. And yep. Yeah, I love the way you keep saying, like, I gave meaning to things.
Yes.
Right? I assigned meaning to things that maybe didn't have as much meaning as I now know, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, the meds probably meant I'm still sick, or there's something wrong with me and I am a bad mom. Like, it really was probably just so attached to that experience. And I think, you know, when that initial, it starts clearing and you're coming out of it, you're still in that like place of trying to reconcile that I'm now diagnosed with bipolar, and there's so much grief that goes into that. Oh. And, it's a really hard thing to reconcile and I think it's such a process, and sometimes part of that process is maybe I don't need these meds that make me feel like I'm sick and that I'm a bad mom and I can do this and I can power through this, you know? And it's hard to then go through it again and have to re-experience it and learn. And I think, you know, I would also wonder, like, do you feel like when you were going through those 6 to 8 months, you know, before you went off your meds, did you feel like maybe there was some depression going on?
Oh.
And that maybe wasn't like that fog was there, and maybe not feeling like that was necessarily in a place that it should have been. Does that make sense?
Exactly. Okay. Right. And again, I did not understand my condition at the time to understand, you know, I had this really euphoric manic high, but that was just a handful of days, and the low, the crashing depressive low, mm-hmm. I was not prepared for. And like you said, I didn't understand at the time. Like it was really bad. And I was not letting the people who needed to know that it was not getting better, that was the case.
Yeah. And the not letting people know it was getting better, do you feel like that was out of fear of having to go back into the hospital?
Oh yes. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm already a burden. I've already scared everybody I know. I don't want to do this again, right? If I say that it's still bad, right? People had kind of already been like, oh, right? She's getting better. It's getting better. I don't want to disappoint them. I don't want. Mm-hmm. And then for me, where I was like, that was the lowest point of my life, right? I don't want to do it again. Mm-hmm. And then, right, it was a reckoning of like, you don't really have, you know, you made this choice, and there is, you know, you are right back. And like Brandon said, the second time, I mean, the bottom, right? What I thought was the lowest point, right? There is always a basement. it was absolutely the lowest point in my life. And I think too, we kind of had the, I don't know if I would say benefit, but the first time, right, there was ignorance of what we were going into. And this time it was like, I knew the monster, like I knew what this was. And I think the second time, you know, I say the first time was scarier for the people around me. The second time, I know it was still scary, but you knew what was going on. But for me, I was just really, you know, it was like, this is going to kill me. Like this disease is going to kill me. I cannot get up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, another psychotic episode. And this time I believed I was dead. And that I had actually completed, the suicide attempt that got me into uni. And, the grief. I mean, Lindsay, you said it before, but just this like grief of I messed up. Like I knew really quickly, believing I was dead, that I messed up, and I like what I wouldn't give, you know, to get back to my family. But like and coming out of that, right, for sure the scariest situation I've ever been in. I remember them trying to negotiate, like you said, when you're with someone who's in an altered mental state, in the beginning, there's no negotiating. I was just weeping and wandering around for days. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of started asking, you know, well, what could convince you maybe that you're not dead? And in the beginning, there was nothing. And again, I just want to emphasize that it's not a half belief. It is a 100%. Every fiber of my being believes this.
Even the second time.
Right? The second time. I am walking around bumping into furniture because I don't feel like I have a body. I'm, you know.
Well, and again, with the physiological, like they evaluated her, and her blood pressure and heart rate were so low that they were considering taking her to the emergency department because her body truly was recognizing that it was dead. The mind had convinced the body. It's called Cotard syndrome.
Yeah.
The body literally was physiologically responding to the input from the brain, which is just so fascinating and also terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. Such a good point too, though, like how powerful the mind is. And like you're saying, it's kind of, it's not this like half, you know, lucid state, right?
No,
it's completely. And you alluded to this earlier, and I just kind of want to bring emphasis to it, because you said in pregnancy you experienced a type of anxiety, hypervigilance, right? And you could tell, like maybe looking back to this was completely different. This wasn't an evolution. Like anxiety turned into psychosis. Like you experienced two completely different things. And just kind of drawing emphasis to how you're speaking about this right now. Absolutely. Yeah.
And Morgan, I think that's a great point, right? This is, our words matter when we're speaking about the symptoms and what that is. And yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I think during both episodes, something that people hearing this will probably be thinking and wanting to know is safety around children or themselves. And you know, when someone has an altered mental state, and like she's saying, it's so hard to get through to me, that you are concerned because you don't know what is going to occupy their mind in the moment, right? And it's almost like Plinko, like you don't know on a day-to-day basis where it's going to drop and what their fixation is going to be, whether that's, like you said, joining the Navy SEALs or buying a Build-A-Bear franchise. Like
that did, yes. That was also on the list.
But, you know, you never know where it was going to end up. And I think the first go around, I didn't know how concerned I should be about that, the personal safety, because I immediately had to go back to work. Because unfortunately in this country, we don't have, you know, any parental, leave. So I, you know, it was the choice of, do I go on FMLA? Will we still have to pay our rent? Or I had saved up my vacation and used it like for his birth and right afterward. I'm back at work and she's going to the outpatient, and I'm wondering, like, I hope they made it safely today. Worrying about that. You have we had to build a lot of checks and balances with that, where, you know, please check in with me when you get there, sure. Sharing location on the phone, yep. even for, and we've talked about that. We don't do that now. But if I come to her and say, like, I think that I'm concerned right now, I think that we need to share location with each other. We know that.
Yeah.
Thank you. One second.
You're good.
But we had to create our own ground rules in coordination with professionals, right? Because I didn't know what to ask for. And that's a question that you can absolutely ask your psychiatrist or, you know, your therapist. What do you recommend so that we trust each other and we can ensure everyone's safety, including Gabby's and our son's, the second go around? You know, a lot of family kind of took shifts right afterward to make sure that Gabby was always with someone, especially if she was with Sagan as well, our son. So it was really complicated. And I don't know that I have a lot of good advice to give to other people because it's such a personal and individualized situation. But I would recommend, if anything, that you talk to a professional about a safety plan.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love this idea of setting up little safety measures of checking in with each other. And it's not, you know, I can imagine for Gabby, it was difficult to have maybe some of those safety measures, but just, you know, kind of trusting within each other of like, this is for my health, and this is to keep everyone safe. And initially this is what we need until over time, there's been some progression and things are stabilizing more. Yeah. Well,
and we know that, I mean, despite being healthy and medicated now, that this could happen in the future. It's always a possibility, right? Yeah. And so we've talked a lot about that. And you have, you know, an emergency stash of medication, which is different than the medication she takes every day, right? And like she said, that off ramp. She also knows that we've agreed that if I come to her, and this is a lot of responsibility and it requires a lot of trust, if I come to her and say, I think that you're a little bit altered, that it cannot be questioned. And we've agreed on that in advance, that there are certain steps that we'll take if I throw up that red flag. Mm-hmm. And like I said, that gives me a lot of power in the situation, and there has to be a lot of trust. I don't know how you could do something like this on your own, without having a partner, but I know plenty of people do it. And, I think in that situation, you need to steer into, like, again, the professionals and professional assistance.
I think something that I really want to draw attention to too, is like you sharing that beautiful experience. It's probably one of the best examples of compassionate boundary setting I think I've heard. Mm-hmm. When you talked about like Gabby's, like, you know, time in uni and you didn't know if your relationship was going to make it, right? And you had kind of come up with these boundaries, like, hey, like, this is what I need some compliance and accountability here. Mm-hmm. And I think you talking just now again is another beautiful example of boundary setting. You guys did so well with each other. And like, that takes so much trust. And I can imagine that you're at this point of trust in your relationship because of those boundaries. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, we always say, you know, boundaries, it's the new B word, right? Like, everyone's like, I'm so sick of hearing that word boundaries, but I don't know. Maybe you tell me if this is like, if I'm on track here, if I'm way off. It sounds like boundaries almost saved your marriage. Mm-hmm. And had a really crucial role in getting Gabby the further help she needed, those boundaries. What do you guys think? Is that?
Yeah, I would agree. Mm-hmm. And I think the compassionate part of boundaries is the piece that Brandon did so well. I stepped out for a second. So, but if you've already talked about the way that he was able to, in the beginning, compassionately control the infield chatter of other people in our lives. So the boundary in the beginning was Gabby can't hold a boundary right now. She's in crisis, right? And so the compassionate part of this is so we're going to protect her, right, from the chatter or from, you know, and so people, I know family and friends where it was truly a needs to know basis. Mm-hmm. And if there was any chatter, it was certainly not done anywhere near me. And so you were really great. The first boundary you had was, right, the support came in, right, venting went out. And so you really didn't vent to me, right? You would vent to other people. I, you know, as at the center of that, right, support flooded in because Brandon was really good at controlling, right? Mm-hmm. The venting is not coming in, right? And the venting is going out and in the beginning, right, fragile, right? And we'll respect that. But you don't get to stay... Yeah. Fragile and boundless forever, right? Mm-hmm. You will grow. You need to continue to grow. We can't sit here. Mm-hmm. And I think that was certainly a piece that I kind of really recognized in uni was, I kind of feel like the first time I went through the program, you know, the programming, I did it because I was like, I got to do it for my marriage. I have to do it for my son. And the second time I did it for me.
I love that.
Like, it is my life. Like, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. Yeah. And so when it turns into you and you step in to take over your life, you have to, it has to be for you. And mm-hmm. yes, in the beginning, if the marriage and the kid gets you through the door, great. But what Serenity taught me was it's for me. Like, this is for my life and my life is worth fighting for. Mm-hmm. And that holding that compassionate space and the boundaries to get me to that spot, right? There wasn't, you know, that you were so protective of my dignity.
Yeah, the dignity was important. Because I can see, even from the first day, I could see on the other side that there were going to be so many questions and it would be tough to explain. And so yeah, that's I didn't know I was doing it right at the time.
You did.
But I mean, in that one instance, there were plenty of other mistakes I made along the way, but sure. I was glad that I did that afterward.
But I think you, and you modeled, right? So when I came out and was like, I just spent $16,000. Oh my gosh. Right. The piece that you did so well was modeling. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
We, other people can take care of that. Doesn't, right. It's not that you didn't spend the money, right? But right now, like, we have bigger fish to fry and it's okay. Okay. Yeah. It's okay.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, I mean, like, that was very easy to explain to people, like, oh, we don't have a return policy. And it's like, I have a note from a psychiatrist. Like,
we'll be returned. Yes.
That's the ultimate Trump.
And, you know what? Like, every single person was fine to work with it. When I explained that it was a medical issue, right? Every single vendor or person that you talked to along the way, I felt like a private detective piecing together where you had been over 2 days and talking to each of those people. And every single one of them was compassionate and understood. And so if you ever feel like you're in a situation where you have to explain it to someone that may not understand, I mean, generally people are good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, Brandon, I think, you know, of course you were going through your own thing through all of this. Right. Mm-hmm. And, even grieving yourself and just probably trying to wrap your head around all of this, but still staying so strong in, like, I'm going to defend her. Even, you know, when you talked about, like, hey, we have this agreement, we don't know where the marriage is going to go, but I'm your defense. I'm going to, like, keep your dignity and defend you and advocate for you. And it just, I think it speaks so much to the importance of the support system and having someone advocate and be in your corner. And it was just so beautifully done. And while you were going through your own stuff, right, with it, of course, how would you not be and be affected by it? And it is just so commendable and just.
Well, I appreciate that. That's I think something that we've talked about this a lot, you know, afterward, how it's changed us, each of us, personally, professionally, all the things. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I went into this as I was in the Marines, and I feel like that was one of the things that helped me just, like, grind it through, was, like, lack of sleep, making decisions on the fly. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, I felt uniquely prepared in a small way for that side of it, that challenge. But you know, Marines aren't stereotypically known as being the most, like, emotionally in touch people. Yeah. That's a stereotype I'm putting on in my own community. But
you are.
I don't think I was necessarily going into it, but what I was going to say is, like, I think through this and working with you and working with so many therapists, man, it has really softened a lot of my edges. And I feel like I'm so much more patient. Not only as a parent, but I think we talked about this recently. I think one of the things, just so strangely, that's been most beneficial to my career and helped me more professionally is actually having gone through this experience. You know, managing my employees, making a personal connection with them, being patient when people have personal things. Like, I understand it as having an employer that was not helpful at the time, my manager, like very difficult to work with through the situation. It made me very resentful. It was really difficult to work through. I'm in such a strange way, like appreciative of everything that we learned along the way.
Yeah.
And for you, I mean, it's benefited you professionally in some minor way.
It completely changed my mind literally changed, right? And chemically and all the things, but I just, again, when we think about the couple, and mean your marriage vows, it's like for better or for worse, especially after that second time and coming out severely depressed, mm-hmm. and you know, having that reckoning with medication, I will be on medication for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And that low, I just kept thinking, like, just let me go. Just like, please give up. Like, I've given up. Like, please just, you know, if you give up, then I can give up too. And you would not. And, you know, modeling, sometimes we don't know how much, you know, just like when I could lean on you when I had nothing, right? When I just did not have that fight at all. And I think that, to see it modeled, right, in the ugliness, when absolutely, right, every, you know, people would say like, oh, I get why you walked away. Wow, what chaos. I mean, it didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's, nothing is more frustrating than trying to communicate to someone something they don't see. I mean, I don't know how to better put that other than like, I could see, even if I wasn't a part of your life, that you were a good mom, mm-hmm. and that you'd continue to be a good mom for our son, and that he needed that and he needed you. Mm-hmm. And that was, I mean, that was my guiding star was, you know, I could see so many things that you did, that I wanted you to pass on to our son and to be a part of his life. And that was really important to me. And it was so frustrating that you didn't see that.
Yeah.
That you didn't see the work that you had done and the ways that you connected with him. And I mean, last night I was putting him to bed and he turned over and he's like, can we swap out? Mom needs to sing me my special song. And I mean, that is exactly why you needed to be a part of his life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love that so much. I think too, Gabby, like, I think, you know, it's so impressive, like what you've gone through led to you to this amazing place professionally. I think you have to tell people what
I think you have
to tell people right now.
I
realize, like, humble brag.
You, yeah, permission. You started talking, I was like, I didn't say. And to that point, right. In the trenches, I had such low expectations of myself. And if I can give, and if I can hold hope to say, right, I am going to take medication for the rest of my life. And with gratitude, because it has afforded me an amazing, super fulfilling and successful on many different dimensions life. And so long from now, I will die with my disease and not because of my disease. Mm-hmm. And that was the reckoning that, that it took. And then I had this guy who, right, Gabby, you cannot just stay sitting down. You have to get up. You have, even if it's just an inch, you have to do it. And so the inch became, you know, Gabby, why, you love yoga. Why don't you go to a yoga, you know, teaching class? Oh no, it's too expensive. Who's going to watch the kid? You know, the depression always has an excuse. And you would not take any of them. And I became a registered yoga teacher. And, you know, when so much of my experience was not trusting my body and not trusting my mind, right? Yoga means personally to me, right? And each mom has something, I think, different, but where it resonates of, it built back trust in myself, right? My body can be trusted. And I am not its enemy, and it is not my enemy. And so I came out with the confidence there, and then applied for grad school. and went to grad school and got my master's in social work. And I am now a therapist. So.
And a good one too.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my gosh.
Thank you.
Very special one. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so had you have shown me that, you know, then I just, and right. And Brandon did and tried to say there, you can be so many amazing things. I just wouldn't have believed it. But you know,
and where we talk about, you know, again, in my small way, compassion with my employees, like if I was experiencing a psychotic episode and I walked into somebody's office to seek crisis help, like I can't think of a better office to walk into, right? As someone that's experienced and lived it. And you may not self-disclose that to every patient, but the amount of patience and sympathy, empathy that you have with that person. I mean, it's inspiring.
Yeah. And I think so many of us, right, it's a helping industry, and our stories can be so different of why we land there. But, you know, I would have never said that I was going to become a therapist ever, ever, ever. Mm-hmm. And then, right, this, it led me to what I get so much purpose, and I get so much, right. Yes. The lived experience, and then the professional side and learning about mental health. Mm-hmm. It's just, there is a fulfilling and happy and fun life, mm-hmm. You know, on the other side. I'm so grateful that I'm in this chair, right. I'm here to share, and, just with a lot of gratitude.
Yeah.
Well, it's the evidence that life does not end mm-hmm. with that diagnosis, mm-hmm. and my quality of life can be good, mm-hmm. and maybe even, like you said, I've grown from this experience, and I've had to lean into things and hard conversations and grown in so personally, emotionally, relationships, and so many different ways of that this experience kind of led you into, and it didn't need to end there.
Yeah. Right? And I think too, and sometimes I always have this balance in my mind of, right, of, you know, to say like, look how good it can be for myself. But unless you were in the trenches, right. It is so difficult to describe. Like, it was a knockdown, drag out fight for a long time, longer than any of us wanted it to happen, right. And to be
right.
It took my expectations, right. The time frame I had just, you know, arbitrarily set in my head.
Right.
No, it took way longer, right. And it was uncomfortable and difficult. And so I always kind of just want to balance both of those, right? Of, you know, right. Here, 5 years on, right? But like you said, even 2 years ago,
talking, right? Yeah.
And it changes with you. It's always a part of our story. It is always, you know, but it gets so much better.
I think I remember sitting, you know, in the chairs, and hearing other people say like, oh, well, I was so happy years down the road, and in the middle of it, like, you don't want to hear that things will be fine in 3 years, right? It's, things got progressively better over time. And not only did it get better, but it was better than it was before. Right. Because you became a completely different person, and you were actually better for it. And I know that many of the other moms that you're still in touch with and things would probably echo the same sentiment that I'm a better person than I was before having the experience, or at least a healthier and happier person.
And I think it's just different too, right? Like,
yeah.
Did I need the trauma to be an awesome soul? No, right. And I wouldn't have picked it. Honestly, I wouldn't have picked it.
You
right?
were an awesome soul. I wouldn't have
picked it. Yeah. Right? But exactly like you said, you become, it changes you. Fundamentally, you cannot walk away from an experience like this not changed in some way.
I think it's like pride in the experience that you learned a lot about yourself, that a lot of like you did a lot of work, right? I think it's the work.
Oh yeah.
And then the tools you get in therapy to like communicate benefit so much too. But mm-hmm. it's yeah, that pride and ownership.
Ooh, I like that.
But early on, it's so hard. And I think that's where doing things like this is kind of like a no-brainer to us. Like, yes, absolutely, because it affects so few people in the way that it affected us. And we know that if anyone else is going through it, like there's so few people that you can talk to about it that yeah. we're perfectly happy and willing to talk to anyone sure. that's going through an experience like this, because it's so rare and we understand and can help, give advice. So thank you for, you know, asking us to participate in this, because it's something that we'll always be passionate about.
Lived experience.
I think we just feel honored, and
so honored.
You know how we feel about you and just the respect and you're just special to both of us.
Yeah, I can't agree more with that. Like
we love you both dearly. Dearly.
What he said. Yeah. Exactly.
It's so important to hear like straight from someone who's experienced mouth. And I, gosh, thank you both. You're just so
much.
Tell like you kept saying the word, you gave meaning, right? Like you gave meaning to all these things. And now you're out here like making it, like you're making meaning.
You get to choose. We get to choose where we make meaning.
Absolutely. I love that.
Right.
And I love it. It comes full circle, right? From like Gabby is a therapist, right? Marine turned passionate leader in the workforce. Like yeah. I'm waiting for your book. That's all I'll say.
I don't know if we have that much patience.
You guys, there were some questions. I think we answered quite a few of them, but maybe just to make sure we touched on them.
Yeah.
So one of them is, you know, what is one thing you would like mental health practitioners to know from your experience?
Yeah, now I live both sides. Mm-hmm. And there's the skill of not knowing mm-hmm. and coming into the room. And what I mean by that, right, is mental providers hold this beautiful information mm-hmm. that the patient generally doesn't have, right? The knowledge, right? This is treatable. This is, you know, here's what it is. I have the language and the words to explain this to you. And so they know, capital K, know right there. But the knowing of that, the experience of the woman, of the family, to come in with the posture of don't assume nothing, and that not knowing, right? Because, you know, I experienced postpartum psychosis, but the next, you know, individual that experienced that could have a completely different lived experience, right? And so yeah. to assume that we knew the resources or that we understood how the disease worked, right? The not knowing. The providers that I feel I connected with the most and gained the most were the ones who really could approach with that posture of not knowing.
You were there to tell us what was going on.
Yeah. Right. And that thing too is it's a dialogue. It is a two way, right. You mm-hmm. have knowledge that I need and you have knowledge, right. You have knowledge that I need. And so to mm-hmm. really understand that there is going to need to be some two way street here.
Right? Yeah. Go ahead, Brian. Sorry.
I was just going to say, my only response is don't forget to the practitioners is don't necessarily forget about the spouse. And part of the beauty of like, Serenity was that the spouses came in once a week.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the case in Seattle, that I was completely detached from what they were working on. Right. But I got regular updates, and felt more a part of the community. And that was really valuable for me. And then I also got time with like your therapist and being able to talk to and give like my observed behaviors like this, well, this is what I'm seeing at home, and we could compare notes. I think that was really useful. And it's scary, like, as the spouse out there is like,
yeah.
you know, they're speaking medical jargon, you don't know if it's going well, but maybe it is, to be pulled into that process and attention be given to me was incredibly meaningful.
Yeah. Yes, supporting the husband. Yeah.
Okay. Like,
what is one thing you want the public to know? Moms, I guess, other moms, other husbands.
Okay. Okay, so I'm also going to say not knowing. And but then here's my answer, or here's my explanation on this one. You know, when we hear about this very rare, you know, a disease that can cause extremely tragic, right? And it seems only when the most extreme case, right, or a really extreme, you know, the case happens, do we have this discussion. But you each, especially women, but all of us control the messages that we send each other about motherhood, about mental health, right? You do not know if that little, you know, comment at the, to the grocery checker about, you know, maybe something negative about mental health, or like, help, you know, don't, oh gosh, don't get help. You're just going to get locked up. Right. Or, you know, that's just a small example, but the small comments that we make at school, at church, at work, about something that we do not know, right? Unless you are a mental health professional, we are speaking on a subject that, you know, our comments accumulate, right? It is a cumulative effect. And so you don't know if that, because I know for myself, right? When people ask, you know, I didn't just wake up, or the assumptions I had about motherhood did not just happen, right? It happened about this social media post and this friend and this person at work who talked about their experience, right? It's cumulative. Mm-hmm. And so we actually all play this really important part in, if you're a licensed professional, right? You have the knowing, the knowledge piece, right? And if you've had lived experience, you can speak on your own behalf. But when we approach each other about motherhood, about parenting, with a posture of, I don't know your circumstance, right? Tell me what that's like. And the most, you know, helpful public, right, like Brandon experienced too, is the posture of, we just want to problem solve for that mom. Oh my gosh, my kid's not sleeping. Oh, have you checked this website? Have you talked to this person who's done this? Mm-hmm. And to take a breath and just say, wow, that sounds really hard. Tell me about that. What's that been like? Mm-hmm. Because the thing is that is your role, right? When I know my role, which is the support or the listener, or I am just a, you know, side character in your life, but it all adds up. Those little comments all add up. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say.
Be curious, not judgmental.
Be curious, right. Not judgmental.
So powerful. Yeah.
Yes.
Such good advice. You keep saying that over and over again, both of you, how much language matters, right?
Yeah.
And yes, I think, you know, we hear like scary things in the news and we fill in our gaps. Like, we're all conspiracy theorists, right? Like, we fill in the gaps with our best information, and that doesn't mean it's accurate information, like you're saying. So that curiosity piece is so, it's okay to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
That sounds so hard.
It sounds so hard.
I can tell you, I can hear you're doing your best, right? Maybe. Oh my gosh, it sounds like you're really... You know, and if you can push them towards the professionals, always, right? Let's get away from like the anecdotes. You know, there's the reputable sources. And I think too, and at least from when I share my story, I can always see it on the other person's face. And the first is always, oh my gosh, like, wow, that sounds so scary. And then I think it's just our natural inclination to, the next thought is, could that happen to me? Oh my gosh, what if that happened to me, right? We immediately take that onto ourselves. And so, I think like you said, Morgan, we worry. We are just inclined to wonder how that could happen to us and want to walk through, oh my gosh, what if? Yeah.
This is so exceptionally rare.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
so lucky.
Is that the word we're going to use?
You get a choice, Gabby. You get to make meaning.
Yes. We choose our word.
I like it.
Yes. We appreciate you again, you guys, so much. Thank you for doing this. And it's so powerful to hear it from someone that's actually been through it. We love to pass judgment and think we know what these stories are like, or what's, you know, what really goes on, or, you know, just how could this happen? And does someone really actually lose full reality? And just speaking to the idea of like, we don't know everything. And it's okay for us not to know everything and to be a more curious and compassionate society. And I like that message. And I just can't thank you guys enough for coming on here and just so eloquently speaking to us and sharing your story.
We appreciate the opportunity. Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you guys.